Enjoyed it.
I'm sorry I didn't reply to you. I just figured I'd, you know.
Every other week.
I'd fit it in.
No, it's all done.
I'm going to open the organizational meeting of the House Committee on Agriculture and Natural Resources. First thing we have to do so we're legitimate is adopt committee rules. Otherwise, apparently everything we do from that point on is moot. So I would, I've lost one vice chair already. That's not a good sign. I would welcome adoption of committee rules by motion if somebody might want to make one. Oh.
Mr. Chair, I would like to make a motion to adopt the rules as printed here with us today.
Great. Vice Chair McLean moves that we adopt the proposed committee rules dated February 2nd. I don't know if any members had any other committees yesterday where you did the same thing, but we're using the same committee rules that have been in other committees. If you have any questions about the rules, now would be the time to ask.
Same rules as 14 years ago when we
came. Yeah.
Consistency.
Yeah, we're sort of status in this business. Any questions on these rules? Any discussion? Any objection? Seeing none, then rules are approved. And so now we're legitimate. We can actually function. So do I now need to open a normal meeting?
A work session.
We had an organizational meeting. So then do we have to open a real meeting? Oh, we're in. Okay. Well, let's start before we just get into work, now that we're legitimate, by introducing ourselves to the audience and to each other. And I'd actually like to start with our esteemed chair of this committee for a long time, Representative Witt. I still like to call him Chair Witt, not only because he chaired this committee for so long, but because he's also chairing all the money. And when we send everything, he's on the receiving end, and we're hoping it doesn't all die, although it's a tough budget year.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chairman. You caught me off guard here. I've got to wake up now. So, I'm State Representative Brad Witt. I represent House District 31, which is the upper northwest corner of our state, all of Columbia County, the part of Washington County north of Highway 26, and that sliver of Multnomah County that slides in between the two of them past Sauvies Island. So very pleased to be a member of the committee, Mr. Chairman, and look forward to working very, very closely with you and the committee members here, and also when some of our monetary issues get sent down to Ways and Means, look forward to working with you on that as well. So,
great. Thank you. And I just want to say, for those of you who haven't had a chance to work with Representative Witt or I, both of us, I think, share similar philosophies about the way you run committees, which is partisanship should be completely left outside. Neither of us, I think, view in any manner people by party, but just by what district you represent and your backgrounds. And we may, you know, at different times ally in different ways, but party won't be one of them. And that's been important, I think, to both of us for a long time.
Amen.
With that, how about I actually go back to my vice chair for her introduction?
Well, thank you very much. This is my second year to serve on this committee, and I was so glad to be back on it. We find so many interesting elements for both urban and rural communities, which I have an experience in. I'm a fifth-generation Oregonian and was raised on a farm and have a lot of interest in the issues that matter to Oregonians in both rural and in our urban areas. And I also am actually the representative for House District 29, which is out Forest Grove, Cornelius, Hillsborough Way in Washington County. And I look forward to hearing about all the interesting items that you bring to us. So thank you. And I'm here to serve the chair and the committee to try and help and keep conversations going between all of us.
Great. I am not 100% sure if our other vice chair is going to be joining us today, so I'm going to hold for now introducing her in case she can introduce herself when she arrives, but she might be out sick, and I don't know that either because we haven't checked our office voicemails. So how about we just continue down this way, and then we'll come back. Greg?
State Rep. Greg Barreto from House District 58, Wallowa County, Union County, and part of Umatilla County. We call that God's corner of the state. And this is my second go-round on Ag and Natural Resources. And Ag and Natural Resources are a huge mainstay up in that part of the state. So glad to be here and glad to serve.
And I'm Kathy McEwen. I represent House District 9. I think Representative Barreto and I are the alpha and the omega of districts.
Yeah, I'm the alpha. <He's>
The coast is very different than where he comes from, but we both are rural. So, that's but correct. We represent different rural areas of the coast. House District 9 runs from the southern edge of the city of Yahats to the northern edge of Yahats to the southern edge of Coos Bay. So I have Coos Bay, Reedsport, Florence, Yahats, Mapleton, Scottsburg, not Wells Creek, and up on the north end, I go almost into Elmira. So I have a pretty good-sized district. Of course, we have fisheries and timber and a lot of issues around water where I live, and I'm delighted to be starting my third term on this committee and look forward to working with our new members. And it's going to be a great session in Ag and Natural Resources.
Agreed. And I'm Representative David Brock Smith. I'm replaced the very large shoes of Representative Wayne Krieger that served on this committee for a very long time. And unfortunately, he actually wanted to call in and harass the new chair, but we didn't set that up.
We should have done that. Next meeting. That's good.
And so I represent south of Representative McEwen's district from the south end of Coos Bay all the way down to Brookings over to Cave Junction and then back up 199 and I-5 to West Roseburg and then back over to the coast. It's House District 1, Curry, Coos, Douglas, Josephine counties, and I like to say the southwest Oregon's Fish Farm and Forestry District. I look forward to working with all of you on this committee. Ag and Natural Resources is a huge area that I've been working on for years as a former county commissioner and city councilor and so forth. So I appreciate my colleagues being here, and I appreciate the comments in the beginning of the meeting that partisanship stays at the door because I agree with you on that. So thank you.
So not to put my new arrival here on the spot, but we're to your turn to introduce Vice yourself, Chair. Madam Vice, Vice Chair.
Hi, I'm Sherry Springer, State Representative from House District 17. And I'm excited to be back on this committee. I haven't been on this committee now for probably a couple, three sessions. So I'm really excited about that. Very rural agricultural district. I represent the cities of Scio, Lebanon, Sweet Home, Waterloo, Staten, Sublimity, Gates, Mill City, Lyons, Detroit, and Idana. Was there another question I missed?
Not really.
Okay. That's good enough.
Another former chair of this committee is next, Representative Escobar.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Sal Escobar, Representative District 6, Medford, which is, of course, a third of the population of Jackson County within the city limits of Medford, but actually Jackson County is a very rural county. I'm also been on this committee for, I don't know, 6, 8 years, something like that. I've co-chaired with a couple people here. Been a very, very interesting committee because and this committee is very unique in the aspect that people park their partisanship at the door and they come through for the betterment of the state itself, and it's very unique. I'm also on the National Sportsman's Caucus for state legislators. I'm on the national board as well, and we're in 48 out of 50 states. We have over 3,000 legislators that are on board with preserving hunting, fishing, trapping, and habitats for that purpose. So pleasure being here, and I'm with some great people here, and it's going to be a lot of fun, I think.
And I really did not mean to put freshmen on the end as if that's somehow a
Low women and men on the
yeah. Sorry about that. I just am realizing I did that. Please.
Hi, everybody. I'm Karen Power. If you were here yesterday for Energy and the Environment, you have already heard this, so I'll keep it brief. I am the new elected representative from House District 41. That's a little bit of southeast Portland, Milwaukee, and Oak Grove and Clackamas County. I'm from Milwaukee, and I'm delighted to be here. My day job provides me with an interesting nexus to our work. I work for a nonprofit that does large-scale cooperative restoration on private agricultural land, largely in Southern Oregon. So that's what I've been doing for the last 5 years for my work, and I'm delighted to be here. I've been following a little bit of what happens at the state level just because it influences us, and I look forward to working with you all.
Great. And I'm Brian Clem. We're sitting in my district, actually. It's a very urban district with the exception of Alpha Nursery, which is the only real farm in my district. There might be backyard chickens in Salem, I think, but that doesn't really count. But my interest in natural resource-related matters come, A, from where I grew up in Representative McEwen's district in Coos Bay, which was largely a timber economy, mostly entirely at that time when I was growing up.
Dairy farming.
Yeah, and a little bit of ag up the river. I used to work in the timber industry, as did my brother, my dad, my grandfather. Then later I married a farmer's daughter. I did not grow up on a farm. I did not know how to drive farm equipment. Didn't know really much about growing. And I left my job with a U.S. senator to go live with my father-in-law and learn how to operate this family orchard, which I did for about 3 years full-time. And we still own a piece of it. I'm just not the main operator and haven't been since I got elected to the legislature. Our cousin does that. But I certainly learned what it was like to have to deal with the regulatory climate, the weather, the vagaries of price in global markets. And it's very challenging for particularly medium-sized family farms who have a lot of volume. But, you know, they're not so small that they could go to a farmer's market and sell everything, but they're not so big that they have huge amounts of marketing staff and everything else. And they really struggle because they're really price dependent and they're price takers, and they don't really have as many tools to deal with bad prices as either small or even bigger growers do, who have their own brands and that kind of thing. So I got elected to the legislature 10 years ago and immediately asked to be on this committee, served on it my first term, chaired it my next two, served on it the one after that, and then unfortunately I was off last year because there was a scheduling conflict with Ways and Means Natural Resources Sub, so I'm happy to be back here. And as I mentioned, I'm pleased to have the opportunity to demonstrate through the operation of this committee the way the legislature ought to work, I think, which is without regard to party affiliation, and fully intend to do that here. So with that, you'll notice I didn't do any informational hearings to get us started. We're just going straight into bills. Part of it is for those of you who are trying to figure out what all we might deal with in this committee based on the fact that there is no longer a Rural Communities Land Use and Water Committee. My expectation is we would continue anything that Ag and Natural Resources dealt with before, which is agriculture, forestry, fish and wildlife, invasive species, mining, and a variety of other issues that have always been AgNat. I think we will get 90% of the land use bills, which isn't always exciting to anyone to hear, but we have a few people here who like land use, so that usually it's a punishment to be on the land use committee, I understand, for many people, but I will not try and make it painless for everybody. And then we should get half or more of the water bills as well. So we have a pretty big jurisdiction and a lot of bills. That's why I'm not wasting any time getting into bills, and if we have time, we will intersperse informational hearings that people might be interested in. Just feel free to let myself or Misty know what you might want to hear about, but we're going to have so many bills, I'm afraid that if we take too much time just talking, we'll run short and not give due time to people who want to come talk about bills as we get a little bit later into session. Misty, would you like to tell us about yourself? I'm sorry I skipped over you.
Sure. My name is Misty Freeman. I am the LPRO analyst for the committee. I was here in the capacity of a graduate student intern in 2013, at which time I got to sort of be an elf in the workshop for this committee and some others related to natural resource and environment, and I'm excited to be supporting this committee again.
And my former admin, I noticed, is paying attention to what I'm doing really closely right there. She's not here to watch Misty. She's here to watch me, I'm quite sure, Beth Riley. Mm-hmm. Okay, so with that, let's move into a work session. So I'm going to open a work session for the possible introduction of committee bills. I've got four here. Those of you who have already been through this in previous sessions will forgive me for repeating this, but those of you who haven't, committee bills introduction by custom, not by rule, by custom, don't imply any support for these bills. They are just typically, although I think I've had it happen once where I couldn't get consent to do it, but typically they are a courtesy to the chair to allow a bill to be put into the mix, and then at the time we hear them is when, you know, really the content becomes discussed and people sort of start to form their positions. So it's always important to say that just in case you look at this and say, oh my God, what is this bill? I don't want to vote for this. The vote is to allow the committee to introduce the bill, not to vote for the bill at this point. If you want a description of any of these, we have one and I could explain it. If you don't care, then I won't go through them. There's four, and we could do them as a group. If people have any questions about any of them, now would be the time to ask. If you don't know what they are, I could give a brief summary. If you don't care, then I'll skip it and we'll just keep going.
I don't think the attitude is, I think we should care to share with the public what we're going to be considering committee bills.
So later we'll have real hearings on these bills. That's when we share the content usually, but I can read them now if you like to hear it. Okay. So the first one, actually, I don't even know the content of the bill, but it relates to wages, and I want the relating clause in case we can do something to try and help agriculture deal with the effects of a rising minimum wage.
What's the number, Mr. Chair?
LC 1535. So the content of the bill, I honestly need to scan this if I'm going to tell you. It appears it has something to do with BOLI dealing with employees who haven't paid their wages and allowing for bonds to be issued. But I can tell you that's not why I want the bill. It's because it relates to wages, and I would like us to do something about the minimum wage as it relates to agriculture, because I think it's going to be pretty hard for ag to stomach it. Number two is LC 1923. That's Representative McEwen's bill. Maybe you could tell us a little bit about it.
Is it?
It's shellfish study.
Oh, in the last long session, we successfully created a shellfish task force.
Yes, please. Yeah.
And it was vetted at length through this committee. The task force took over a year to bring forward what this bill will contain. This is the culmination of a year's worth of work on the shellfish task force, Mr. Chairman, is what that is.
Okay. LC 3880 comes to us from around the Junction City area. It was former Representative Hoyle's issue, and we'll hear more about it at the time, but it has to do with an issue that came up where somebody had one of their outbuildings destroyed and are trying to rebuild it and now running into serious problems with removal fill permits just to rebuild something that was destroyed by fire. And when she retired, she didn't get this in, so asked if I could get it in the works. And it's a farmer from the Junction City area who experienced this. I assume this happens other places in the state, but I know Representative Olson has some issues around removal fill, but I don't know that they're about fire replacement. And LC 3881, I cannot remember who asked me to put this in. I think it was Mr. Honeycutt. But it exempts from requirements of removal fill laws parcels that are not on the wetlands or statewide wetland inventory. And this has to do with people trying to figure out whether they're in a wetland or not, and there's publicly available documents if they are, and then often they're not on those, so they begin, and then they find out that they have been determined to be. And I think this bill aims at getting at more certainty so people know if they're in them or not. Again, this vote isn't about the contents of these bills. This is to allow them to be, or sorry, these legislative concepts. These are to allow them to become bills. Then we would have hearings to further illuminate what these bills at that point would actually do. So those are the four. Any questions about those? Okay.
Mr. Chair, I move that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1535, dated 12/13/16; LC 1923, dated 10/3/16; LC 3880, dated 1/23/17; and LC 3881, dated 1/24/17.
Vice Chair Springer moves that the following LCs be introduced as committee bills: LC 1535, 1923, 3880, and 3881. Any discussion? Okay, seeing none, any objection? If not, then the measures are introduced as committee bills. And I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2266 and ask Shannon from ODF&W to come up. I don't know if you're bringing anyone, and you're bringing somebody. And then we've got testimony coming up on a sign-up sheet. If there's anybody who missed it, please let our committee staff know. But I've got, looks like maybe two other guests on this bill after the department talks. Generally speaking, just so you all know, these first few days are all agency bills. The only reason I did that is a lot of times people aren't ready with their bills, and no offense to the agencies, but they had a lot longer than we did, given they all get paid to work full-time and we don't, to get their bills ready. And so a lot of times people don't want their bills because they're not quite ready yet, and somebody's got to go whether they're ready or not. So I've made the choice to have the agencies come and talk about their bills. And some are panicked, I know, not you, but some are panicked that they're up so soon. But somebody's got to go, so we're getting started with agency bills first. For the most part, Farm to School almost went today, but I decided it was better to wait for Oregon's birthday, since it's such a patriotic bill for Oregon that we've got to celebrate Farm to School on a special day coming up here pretty soon, which is Valentine's Day. Okay. Enough Farm to School, back to fish hatchery funding.
All right. Good morning, Chair Klim, Vice Chair Springer, Vice Chair McLean. We really appreciate the opportunity to discuss House Bill 2266 with you today. I am Shannon Hearn, the Deputy Director at the Department of Fish and Wildlife. With me today is Kevin Goodson. He's our Acting Conservation and Recovery Program Manager. I have been having discussions since March on this concept, and every time we have these conversations with folks, it gets tangled very quickly. So I reworked this last night trying to simplify and make it more clear the history, the issues, and what House Bill 2266 is intended to do. So hopefully I'm successful at that. But in the 2015 legislative session, Oregon Law 734 was revised to create the Oregon Hatchery Research Center Fund and the Hatchery Construction Fund. So the Oregon Hatchery Research Fund receives revenue from ad valorem commercial fish sales and a surcharge on licenses, a portion of the surcharge on angling licenses. And so the language in the law requires that any funds not expended or unobligated at the end of a fiscal year will be moved from the research fund over into the Hatchery Construction Fund. So House Bill 2266 is intended to modify that language so that funds can accrue in the research fund over fiscal years and therefore could be used for further research at the Hatchery, Oregon Hatchery Research Center. But House Bill 2266 also provides language that would allow the Hatchery Construction Fund to receive other avenues of funding, so including but not limited to donations, gifts, bequests, those kind of things. The Oregon Hatchery Research Center Board, they were created in the 2013 legislative session. They've developed a research plan. They have three projects going currently. They have expended all the research funds and are funded through Oregon Hatchery Research Center Fund. And they anticipate going longer than the 10 years that the funds were actually set up for and needing additional funds to do additional research. And I think we have a board member here today that you'll hear from. I'll let
him describe more what the Hatchery Research Center does. I just wanted to focus on the bill. And we think by allowing other fund sources in the Hatchery Construction Fund, this provides additional opportunity to invest in coastal hatcheries, particularly improving them, upgrades, those kind of things. And it's just geared at coastal hatcheries, the Hatchery Construction Fund. That's where those monies are dedicated to. We do have a hatchery deferred maintenance that covers all hatcheries. We have a fund for that, but this one in particular just is for coastal hatcheries. And so what we're seeking to do is optimize those funds for research while still providing an avenue to do that hatchery construction and maintenance. Hopefully that's somewhat clear. So Kevin, would you like to add anything?
I guess I would just add that the three projects
Kevin,
that
Kevin, first we have to have
I'm
you
sorry,
identify yourself.
I apologize. For the record, my name is Kevin Goodson, Acting Conservation Recovery Program Manager. Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, and Vice Chair McLean. I would just add that the OHRC research plan that our board developed and approved has three priority topics, but as we were developing those three topics, we recognized there are other things related to the mission of the Hatchery Research Center, which is to try to investigate and understand the interactions between hatchery and wild fish and try to minimize those as much as possible, that there's other research that needs to be done. And so the three projects we've started with are likely to use a lot of the funds that are going to accrue through the surcharge and the ad valorem fees. So we wanted to have an opportunity if in a particular year we don't expend all of those funds that have accrued, we can hold on to those and then use them again in the following year or to advance the research, and then also if new priorities come up, we can possibly divert some funds into that as well. So that was the purpose for this. By doing that, then, that meant we weren't going to be, there wasn't as much of an avenue for funds to go into the Hatchery Construction Fund, so that's why the language added into that to allow for other sources of revenue to go into the the Hatchery Construction Fund. So hopefully that makes it clear. Or maybe I've muddied it up.
So previously, the Hatchery Construction Fund got monies that were rolled over basically from the other fund.
Unspent.
And monies transferred to the fund by the Legislative Assembly. Now you would have anything that's appropriated newly, not just rollover money and any gifts, etc. And it allows you to, well, you already could keep the funds year to year by rolling it into this, couldn't you?
Chair Clem, that first part was correct. We don't believe that once they go in the Hatchery Construction Fund, they can come back out for research. One thing I will mention, too, we asked our legal counsel to look at the definition of unobligated, thinking if you had a contract in place and you thought those funds were going to be used for mm-hmm. research, could you hold them in that account? And what we've been told is no, actually, you would have to have a signed agreement contract in place to do that research and obligate them that way, or else they are automatically meant to go into that construction fund.
And Chair Clem, just to clarify, we haven't rolled any funds into the Hatchery Construction Fund yet. We have been spending all of the funds as they've been accrued, at least for the first fiscal year. Now we've got this fiscal year has more funds being accrued because it's got a full year of the surcharges on fishing licenses. So that's where we may see a potential at the end of this fiscal year that there could be funds that would be required to go into the Hatchery Construction Fund.
And you said this started in 2013?
2015. Actually, the
legislation
fees
passed
went into place for the 2016 year. So actually, it was December of 2015 was the first funds on fishing license, 2016 fishing licenses being sold.
Okay.
Were the first funds going in.
I'm sure you gentlemen know about this. I wasn't here. So it sounds like a Krieger thing somehow to me. But
it is.
Yeah,
it is.
That's what I think.
Fingerprints are all over this thing.
Representative Esquivel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have Would you read line 24 through 26, please, and explain to me why that's worded where it would say current coastal hatchery facilities? Wouldn't this be retained into the research center instead of, quote, coastal hatchery facilities, plural, for the expenditure of monies?
Well, I don't have what you're reading. I apologize.
What's the bill?
Oh, yeah, sorry.
That's not it either. I just realized I grabbed the wrong one.
You don't have the bill?
No.
Okay. Everyone's paperless. I don't like paperless because I like.
I assumed you had the bill.
Well,
I thought I
was being cut.
I apologize. That
part's current law, but the question is now, is it still right? Or do
well,
we need to amend
my
that
question
too?
Is if we're going to allow people to bring in monies into this fund, we aren't going to expend this money because that's kind of just for this particular research center. I don't want to be bringing in money on the research center and saying, okay, this is for the research center, and then turn around and send it to some other hatchery. That's my concern with the way that's worded.
So do we actually have just one research center?
Yeah. Well, Chair Clem, yes, we only have one research center.
But Mr. Yeah. Chair, it doesn't say that.
Yeah. Well,
coastal facilities, plural.
But the Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, the Hatchery Construction Fund, once it goes in there, is meant to facilitate any state-owned hatchery on the coast, so Band and Elk River Salmon. It was, when I spoke with Krieger, it was never meant just to cover Oregon Hatchery Research Center upgrades. It was meant for all coastal hatchery facilities. And it was set up that way so extra funds could go in there. We could start doing deferred maintenance that he felt we really needed. That was his explanation to me.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, follow up.
So then, in other words, what we're saying is we're doing a surcharge on people's license for the research center, but that money could eventually end up into other hatcheries?
That is how the accounts are set up now.
This is just the construction fund, not the research.
I'm not sure on that one.
But this bill changes
I don't believe that. Okay, I can't speak for Representative Krieger, but...
And I'm not going to put his I'd love to put his replacement on the hook, but how's he going to know either? Representative McEwen?
Chair Clem, the way I'm reading this, Section 2 refers to the construction fund. Mm-hmm. So there's two pots of money. Section 1 is the hatchery research money, and Section 2 is just the hatchery construction money. So is that helping to clarify
up in 13 and 14 it says monies in the first fund, that research fund may only be expended on research projects recommended by the board,
and
so that's purely research. Then this other fund is the construction fund, and this fund may only be expended on upgrades, improvements, etc. of hatcheries. So they both have their own limitation to the fund. And both of those are current law. This bill isn't changing anything about either of those.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I guess it does, but I'm still uncomfortable with that, and I think maybe we'll...
We're not voting today, obviously. No. This is just a hearing, so we can call...
I'd like to tighten that up.
Call Wayne, see what he has to say.
Because I will call Wayne and ask him what he thought.
Wake him up during his nap.
Yeah, don't wake him up in his nap time.
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, we're open to modifying that language if you would like it to be more specific to...
Thanks.
...to use at hatcheries that are taking the research findings from the OHRC and implementing new techniques that need improvements. That would be one approach you could look at to kind of tie that money to the research.
Yeah, we'll dabble with it. We'll figure it out.
Yeah, Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. As I stated earlier, big shoes to fill.
Yeah.
Uncle Wayne, what do you want to do with this?
Pardon me?
Uncle Wayne, what do you want to do with this?
Yeah. I remember a conversation about this where Representative Krieger was concerned about the deferred maintenance on, of course, the Elk River Hatchery and other hatcheries, and the need for revenues to supply it. I will have a conversation with him specifically about this and then come back to you and discuss intent. if that's okay with the committee.
It almost looks to me like what this line, and again, this is current law, this bill doesn't touch it, but what 24 through 26 does is tries to limit the use of the fund to current hatcheries and not allow it to be used to build new ones.
Right.
That seems to be the point of this control.
Coastal.
Is improve, upgrade, or replace current ones.
Correct.
Mr. With new technology, but don't build any new ones with this money, even though it's called the Hatchery Construction Fund, so it sounds like you might be building new ones, but this limitation says no, you aren't building new ones with this money. Representative Brock-Smith.
Mr. Chair, and the important piece is the end of line 25, where it talks about in order to incorporate new technologies to make physical improvements to the hatcheries, because on the Elk River specifically, they have reduced the number of the hatchery fish in the program because of the wild salmonids and the need for the wild salmonids. Am I there?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you.
It's creepy.
And so they're working at the salmon hatchery to find a way, and I don't quite grasp all of it, but basically, in a nutshell, the elevator version is hatchery fish are not quite as smart as wild fish when it comes to coming back to their rivers and spawning. And so they're trying to figure out the genetics between the two. And there's also the sense that they're trying to put in the waters to differentiate between the wild fish. And all of those are the technologies that are referenced here in line 25 and 26 that I believe that he wanted to incorporate. But there needs to be dollars behind those in order to, because you can do all the work that you want at the hatchery or at the Salmon Research Center, but unless you can incorporate those that research and changes into the hatchery program itself, it's really all for naught.
Okay. Representative McKeon?
Just one more clarification, and I may be not reading it here correctly. So what I'm hearing this say is monies that are in the research fund that come from the ad valorem tax at the end of any given year, who's going to make the decision as to what stays in the research fund and then what gets moved into the construction fund? Am I understanding correctly that how is that going to be determined?
Rep. Clem. Representative McKeown, Chair Clem, Representative McKeown, that's exactly the position we're in of trying to decide and do the accounting ourselves and then determine if we're meeting the intent there. And by the definition of unobligated, if we don't have a research contract in place, we feel we automatically roll them over.
Okay.
Yep.
So that's determined by the agency. Does the board of the Hatchery Research Center weigh in? What's the nexus there?
We have, Chair Clem, Representative McKeown, we have a representative who sits with that board and discusses the finances, and they do weigh in on those decisions.
Okay, I'd like to hear from
you. Yeah.
But Chair Clem and Representative McKeown, we still would have the problem, even if the board were to say with the current law that, well, we don't want you to put that money into the Hatchery Construction Fund because we have an idea for something,
yeah.
We'd have to say, well, right now it's unobligated. We're, by law, we have to put it into the Hatchery Construction Fund. So that's why we want to have that flexibility to be able to say, okay, we'll just hold on to that money then.
Follow up. But that will be done in conjunction with the Board of Directors of the Hatchery Research Center. So they will have, they will be able to weigh in on these decisions that you will be making about their money. Is that
Chair
a good
Clem,
way
Rep.
to say that?
Rep. McKeown, that is fair to say that.
Okay. Thank you.
And I'll just add, Chair Clem and Representative McKeown, we have quarterly updates we give to the OHRC board on the revenues that are coming in from the surcharges and our expenditures. So we constantly talk with them. We have a business plan for the research plan that our board watches very closely and checks up on to see whether we are spending the money the way we intended to spend it in the research plan. So mm-hmm. So the board is very involved and it oversees this very well.
Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. My question actually does not follow along this line of questioning. I can hold my question if any of the committee members have.
Yeah, okay. We'll come right back to you. Vice Chair McLean.
I think that Representative McEwen got two of my questions answered. But the one that I still have some issues on is basically the one part is you're just being able to accept money and gifts. That's one part. And it can go into the fund. That's pretty straightforward. But then there seems to be two layers on the money from the research fund to the construction fund. And one is how much stays in one account or if it's rolled over. So that was your answer that made that clearer. And so it's easier for you to do your accounting if there's a little more flexibility there. The other question that seems to be there is if you put it into the construction fund, construction sounds like new construction or a new hatchery, and it looks like what the language that you guys were discussing on 24 through 26 or 27 was basically it could be used for maintenance and or care of existing hatcheries, you know, where it looks like now it couldn't be. Is that a true statement or close to it?
Current law looks like it can't be used for any new ones.
Right.
Is 24 through 26 not in bold is current law. So it to me looks like you can only use, even though it's called Hatchery Construction Fund, it can't be used for construction of a new hatchery.
Are you currently looking at the bold on 23 through 27?
No. 24 starting with the word monies.
Yes.
Monies in the fund may be expended only to improve, upgrade, or replace current coastal hatchery facilities.
Right, so that's current law.
It's current law.
So I'm asking if they're trying to change that so there's more flexibility before, you know, between construction and maintenance of current facilities.
This bill doesn't, but you want to know if they're trying to.
I want to know what the purpose of the bill is. If that's something that's an issue, yeah. If that's a contention with the board.
So, Chair Clem, Representative McLean, that is our interpretation as well. It cannot be used to build new hatcheries, and we have no desire to see it used that way, and we would like it kept to improve our facilities for the reasons that Representative Smith stated.
Okay.
Yep.
And back to Representative Witt.
I got my question answered. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was wondering if it would be possible without a great amount of work on the department's behalf to provide the committee members here a list of the research projects that are being conducted by the Hatchery Research Center.
Yes, you can do that.
Perhaps how long a period of time that particular research project is expected to last, how many years into it we are, and what is it that we're actually researching. And not a book, you know, a paragraph or two at most on each of the hatchery projects, I think would be very helpful. At least it would for me.
Chair Clem, Representative Wood, just for clarification, would you like the list of research that the research fund is funding or all the, because we have also have research that researchers come into the OHRC
from around
and bring
the world
their own
mm-hmm.
funds and they conduct research. So there's quite a list of research that either has or is being done at the OHRC unrelated to the OHRC fund. So do you want that bigger list or do you want just the list of research related to the fund?
Well, I think principally if we could have maybe all of the fund's research projects described and then maybe an addendum that says include and we also have the following projects maybe not as in-depth reporting on those.
Thank you. Got it.
Thank you very much.
Is that basketball? Did you have something?
No, I'm okay. I just wanted to know that if they go out and they start these new projects or new research, is that stimulated from the research that we're currently doing, or is it somebody has a great idea and we just decide to try it?
Chair Clem, Representative Escoval, it'll kind of depend. We do, as we start into research, a lot of questions get answered, but then that raises other questions, and so it could be that we will recognize that there's a side channel we need to go off into to explore a part of something we learned during our research, or it may be that some new research will come from somewhere else that'll suddenly make us realize, wow, that's the biggest issue we have with hatchery and wild interactions, and we probably should be redirecting some funds into that. So it kind of depends. We intend to finish up the research that we've started. We're not going to just go halfway and then say, oh, we want to do something else.
And when do we expect to see a report on the finished product of this research? Because we can research and research and research, but what's the final outcome here?
Chair Clem, Representative Esquivel, that's the answer you're not going to like. The problem we have is that the research that we're conducting starts with kind of trying to understand a mechanism, or in the case of the Elk River research that we're doing as part of the research plan, we're investigating some chemical cues we can put into the hatchery water supply that would then potentially attract the hatchery fish back into the hatchery better than it currently does, so we could have more of the hatchery fish come back to the hatchery rather than spawn in the wild. So the first part is trying to figure out what those chemical cues would be. Then the next part is to actually implement it at the hatchery and raise fish and release them, wait for them to come back as adults to see whether they actually. So a couple years of doing the chemical cue part, and then it would be probably 8 years or more before we would start to have enough years of adult returns coming back to be able to say it worked or it didn't work. It could be that after 2 years we see the exact same results. It's tremendous change, and we'd be pretty confident in letting you know then that it appears this is the result. But unfortunately, with salmon and their long life history, it takes multiple years, and you need to do it for a couple of generations to make sure it wasn't just ocean conditions that caused a particular return to occur. So,
Mr. Chair,
yeah,
I'd like to make a statement here.
Sure.
All the freshmen pay real close attention to this, because I'm not going to be here when this thing 8 years from now. I'm not going to be here.
Mr. Chair.
Pay attention.
Representative Smith.
Thank you. This is one of the issues with regards to research and the fact that the salmon does. But my understanding is you also had this part of this research came from outside of the research area, and so that's the beauty of allowing the hatchery center to allow other researchers to come in, because they were researching this somewhere else, if I remember correctly, and we were able to piggyback on, and now we're trying to get through the implementation phase of the sense in the water. Meanwhile, we're having it's an issue in both our districts because of the reduction of the hatcheries fish into our rivers and streams, which of course has recreational anglers and commercial anglers a little concerned. So the sooner the better, so that we can get those hatchery numbers back up and promote the recreational anglers again.
President Brenner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I'm just curious how large these funds are, but the construction fund and the research fund.
Chair Clem, Representative Barreto. So in the last legislative session, the legislature gave us $600,000 of general fund to kind of kickstart the fund, and then the surcharges went into effect with the 2016 licenses year. So we have forecasted with the surcharges and the ad valorem fees on commercial landings should generate about $600,000 a year, or 1.2 a biennium. So this biennium with that $600,000 of general fund, but only three quarters of a biennium's worth of the surcharge and ad valorems, it's about $1.5 million is what we anticipate that fund altogether would have accrued and we'd have to utilize.
Okay. Thank you.
Vice Chair McLean.
Well, we had a wonderful last session. We had a wonderful presentation about this facility and about how important this facility is, and how, if you care about salmon, the environment, clean water, that this is the kind of research that has to be done for us to get the answers for how to keep it that way or get it better in better form in the future. So, I mean, this is something I completely, absolutely support, the facility and the idea and the concept that got sold in, and you've got a good fee-based type of future. But I think right now, it seems so unclear to me specifically what the goal is, number one, on some elements, and two, how it works. As far as the board, I'm hoping we have other folks coming up to talk about that. But I just think that maybe, Mr. Chair, that the next time we hear about this bill, that maybe we could have like a one-pager that says current status quo goal or something like that, that would just really lay out specifically what the process for decision making is, what the amount of, you know, what the issue is, and what you've cleaned up, what the problem is, what the solution is, and what you've cleaned up, because it's still a little foggy for me.
Sounds good. Okay, any other questions for this panel? We've got another one coming up next. We'll see what they have to say. Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
And Joe and Tom, do you want to come up, our resident fish? Bob, are you just going to abandon your two amigos? No? Just no help for them? And I don't remember Seafood Oregon as the group before that you represented. So tell me about Seafood Oregon.
Okay. Second here. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Joe Rollator. I live in Walport. I represent Desert Springs Trout Farm, which is a large trout farm in Eastern Oregon, private trout farm in Eastern Oregon, and Seafood Oregon, which are the four commodity commissions that commercial fishermen pay into. And the commodity commissions do marketing, and then my role here is to provide information to the commodity commissions about what the legislature might do. And as another side of that, I kind of help move things along. And that was my role in the development of the two pieces of legislation around the research hatchery. I was the person who went to committee chair, to the legislative council back and forth for Senator Roblin, Representative Witt, and Representative Krieger. So I came into this hearing this morning thinking that I really knew what this bill does.
Yeah.
So, and I don't want to confuse this anymore. So I'll just tell you what I understood. Our intention was to, with the two bills, the bill that reestablished the center and gave it some goals, and then the dedicated fund from license fees. So we wanted to make sure that this research hatchery could function in a way that works with salmon. Chinook salmon come back at age 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6 in the coastal rivers. And so you need to have 12 or 15 or 20 years to really do definitive. So it needs to be long-term and it needs to be stable funding. But we also realize that research sometimes goes in spurts and bounds. And so there might be some money left over from one particular biennial's research project that didn't get allocated. And that money should go in to a fund that could be used all the time to implement the results or the improvements recommended by the research hatchery in coastal hatcheries. So the way the biennium works with ODF&W's budget, sometimes it's 3 years from the time we get an idea that we need to add something like an oxygenator at a hatchery and the time we have the money. Whereas the Representative Krieger and company intended to have a little bit of money available so that when some research starts to look solid enough to invest some money in, that we have the money to invest during a very short period with a very short period of time. And I think I'll leave it there. Thank you.
Chair Clem, Committee members, for record, my name is Tom Wolf. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Council of Trout Unlimited, here to represent the 3,200 members of TU in our state and 160,000 across the nation. Trout Unlimited, and I've already sent in written testimony that should be able to view electronically, but as per what I normally do, I'm going to deviate totally from that written testimony. So Trout Unlimited has been involved with the two bills that Joe mentioned. We've supported both the reformation of the Hatchery Research Center and the board, and the special license fee. And we support the concept that leftover money should be used for research and hatchery research, because one of the big problems that we face is, you know, groups like mine that have view hatcheries with a certain amount of suspicions also agree that hatcheries are never going to go away, and they're always going to be a vital part of what we do in recovery and restoration of salmon and making sure that people have fish to catch and use either commercially or recreationally. So we need to be able to do the best research, and the Oregon Hatchery Research Center is one of the best research places in the world, and maybe even could be defined as the best for doing research like this. So it needs money. You need money to do research, and it's important that you have this money within leftover money that can be recycled and keep being used for research. Now, as far as the hatchery, the part that the maintenance, I have to be honest, I was so excited about the first part of this bill, I didn't read that part, so I'm a little concerned. And again, I find myself here in my last session that I'm going to be at, that I agree with another guy that's here in his last session, full session, Representative Esquivel. Who ever thought that I'd be agreeing with him on issues? But here we are. So I have concern about where that money. I think the money, if we want to use the money for fixing up facilities on Hatchery Research Center, I'm all for that. I have a little bit of heartburn as far as using the money just as a general construction. If we want to use the money on some of the hatchery research, the hatcheries on the coast, to in the last line on 25 and 26, to incorporate new technologies or make physical improvements to the hatchery research, incorporate new technologies, all for that. Making improvements in the hatchery facilities, all for that. Also, just fixing Band-Aids to hatcheries, not for that. So I echo what has been said by Joe and what Representative Esquivel, and make sure that this bill focuses on keeping money, research money in, and making the Hatchery Research Center facilities better, but not providing Band-Aids for just fixing hatcheries on the coast. Thank you.
Any question for these two gentlemen? Questions? Okay. Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing. Anybody else here on this? That's all I've got signed up. Close the public hearing on House Bill 2266. I will say at this point, generally speaking, my practice is to hold public hearings and work sessions on different days so you have time to think about it. It's possible if we get dozens and dozens and dozens of bills later, I might not be able to adhere to that, but so far I've chaired four terms and I've never had to do it all in one day. But I'll ask you if you're comfortable doing it. If it comes up that we think we should do something on the same day, I'll ask you first. But normally don't panic if you're listening and not ready to vote. You won't be asked to vote that day, as far as I can see, in the foreseeable future happening at all. With that, public hearing, let me open a public hearing on House Bill 2321. And I'm going to ask Ashley Massey from the Marine Board to join us.
Sorry, we're going to do Scott.
Nope, Scott's coming instead.
Mr. Chair, I thought we had a member of the committee for the hatchery that was going to testify.
Yeah.
Dr. Ball's here.
Did somebody want to testify from the board? Would you like to? Oh, yeah, Lindsay came all the way here. Why don't you come back? Okay, so let me
close
the public hearing on 2321 temporarily.
Dr. Ball.
Yeah. Dr. Ball. And
Mr. Ball, sorry.
Reopen the public hearing on House Bill 2266. And you're somewhere out east now. Where are you living? I forget.
Sir, I live in Pendleton, Oregon.
That's right. So you came a long way. We shouldn't have you just sit there and listen, Lindsay.
Well, you know...
Oh, and for the record, we should have you identify.
My name is Lindsay Ball, resident of Pendleton, Oregon, and I'm the vice chair, one of the vice chairs for the Hatcher Research Center. Our chair... Cam Perry couldn't be here today, and the other vice chair, Scott Starkey, couldn't be here today. And so you got me.
You drew the straw.
That's fine. And honestly, make sure everyone understands, this is my policy. I've been involved in fish and wildlife my whole career, and so I volunteer for these things. I come free of charge. There's no expense account submitted by me for travel or anything else. So
for those who don't know you, maybe you could give us your pedigree. We had some people on here who may not know the famous Lindsay Ball.
I'm not famous.
Oh.
Let's see. Oregon State Police, Fish and Wildlife Enforcement. 1975 until 2001. Moved through the ranks up to the captain of the division. I was then asked in 2001 by Governor Kitzhaber to go to Portland and be the director of Fish and Wildlife. Now, I'll tell you a little story about that. Governor called me into Bill Wyatt's office, chief of staff. This is kind of funny. I kind of get a kick out of it. It's kind of a deal on me, too. So they were talking, so I was sitting off to the side. And all at once, they stopped. The governor looks at me and he says, Lindsay, I want you to go to the Department of Fish and Wildlife and be the director. My response? Well, thanks, Governor, but you know, I've got a good job. He looks over at Bill Wyatt and he says, Bill, I don't think you heard me. And so I says, gotcha. And so I went to be the director of the Department of Fish and Wildlife. And then I was the director at the request of Governor Kulongoski to go to DAS. And I finished my career there as the director. So there you are.
There you go. And now you're volunteering for free for the same things.
Yes, sir.
Good deal for the state.
Yep. The chair sent me some narrative that he'd like me to report to you. The OHRC board is supportive of House Bill 2266. The bill will modify language in the existing OHRC fund to allow any unexpended or unobligated funds to remain in the OHRC research fund from one fiscal year to the next. Allowing the slight modification of the OHRC research fund law will provide the OHRC board with more flexibility to fund research related to the interactions of hatchery and wild fish. Because the research plans projects are cutting edge, the fund will allow us better fund aspects of research that weren't initially anticipated. In other words, it's a growing scale. It's a moving animal, so to speak, that's going to have different things at different times in different places. And just not in the research center itself. A lot of this is going into the field work as well. In addition, the modification of the OHRC fund law will allow ODFW to accept outside funds into the hatchery construction fund. This will provide a source of funds that can be used to make modifications to coastal hatcheries that result from the research that is conducted through OHRC. One suggestion I have is that the committee should consider if the proposed language would allow federal appropriations to be deposited into the hatchery construction fund. There are funds at the federal level that could support construction work at some of our hatcheries in order to facilitate the science and the research results. It may be that OHRC fund will point to hatchery improvements that Congress will be interested in funding. As chair of the OHRC board, I strongly recommend the committee to pass House Bill 2266. The creation of the OHRC fund was an important step to ensure that important research related to hatchery and wild fish interactions occurs. Making the slight modification called for in House Bill 2266 will ensure we can maximize the research supported by the OHRC fund. Now, advice, if you may, Chair, from my experience, it is good for a committee such as yourselves, and it's excellent for you to ask questions of us and to reaffirm where the dollars are going, when the dollars, what the dollars are spent for, and how they're defined to be spent. It's extremely critical, and I really appreciate the discussions started this morning along that line. We don't want to make a mistake. We don't want to create some kind of a loophole where monies kind of escape to something that really wasn't the intent of the people who voted for it. And I think that's very critical. It's going to take time. It's tedious. I know, but in the long run, it makes everyone feel comfortable that the money's going in the right place. Uh-huh. I can see that today. With that, Mr. Chair, may I describe something that I think is very important and very telling about what the Research Center has accomplished. And it's very, very demonstrative in, I think, what the future holds for the Research Center. We never knew how fish migrated in the ocean. Not until this last year or so. We turn loose, they take off. We know that they go to this part of the ocean, in the Pacific, this part, and so on. But how do they find their way? If you stop and think about it, most wild animals have a parent to take them on their journeys, to introduce them to the world. When a when a little fish becomes a yolk sac fry and leaves the gravel, he's an individual. He doesn't have mom, he doesn't have dad, and just the others are the same way. All the others that come out of the same red, they're on their own. And so the question was, how do they end up knowing to go to the Bering Sea? And how do they find it when they outmigrate? One of the things that we suspicioned was that it was electromagnetic field of the Earth. And this also is going to describe a little bit why some of this research gets open-ended and long. We found that through going to the electro engineers at Oregon State University and us describing to them what we want to test, we wanted to know if they could mimic or duplicate the electromagnetic field of the Earth. We knew it was out there. We didn't know how well we could do it. Well, they kind of laughed at us, basically, and says, yeah, we can do that. We've been doing it for years and years and years. And so they came up with an idea of what would work for us to test little fish. And they came back a week later. Now, what am I telling you about this? This is one of the gifts that being attached to Oregon State University comes as a real benefit to us. So they told us what they needed, 1,000-gallon tank set up in the air 15 feet on wood stilts. They would come over, put their machine on it. They wrapped 3 bare copper wires on top, 3 around the middle, 3 around the bottom. We put in 100 fall Chinook fish that were ready to smolt in the tank. And so Dr. Noak said, turn it on for the Bering Sea. Turn it on for the Bering Sea. In 2 minutes, all those little fish turned to the south. They were going to come home. They're in the Bering Sea. Time to go home, fellas. And they all turned and pointed south. He then asked him to turn it for Hawaii. So the electro engineers switch it to Hawaii. In about 2 minutes, they all pointed north. They wanted to go to the Bering Sea. And we repeated this time and time again. We set it out for scientific review. It was accredited by panels who looked at this, and it was replicated many times over. And Therefore, we now understand how they can migrate across the ocean. We know that olfactory senses in the fish is critical when they come back here, because then they pick up the sniff of their natal stream, and then they're going home for sure. And they can find their way easily. And that is extremely powerful scent that they've put in their brain when they left the natal stream. And it's carried with them their whole life. And when they come back, it's put to good use to come back home. And that's some of the things that Kevin Goodson mentioned about some of the straying issues that we've seen and so on. And that you heard other testimony from other people about that. Here's the punchline on this whole thing that I described to you. When we got accreditation for scientific research gone good, met all the parameters for scientific proof, we turned that out, or Dr. Noakes turned that out on the web. In 1 week, we had 115,000 hits from fishery scientists around the world on that research. They were looking for the same answers that we were. And that brings a lot of focus and attention to our research center. When it's recognized internationally that way, people want to come here and be a part of it. And that brings us additional funding sources, which is all good. I think what you're starting to see is a research facility that's really starting to come of age. It's matured. Our name is out there. And people are looking to us for some guidance into the future of fish management. It's all good. And that was one of the visions I had when we built the center, to have this as a international destination for fishery scientists. And I think we're there, or at least we're getting there. And but this has been a process, and I commend the legislature for all that they've done. And for helping this get underway. I think this will prove advantageous for Oregon and for many, many other countries around the world before we're all done with it. Any questions?
Representative McEwen.
Oh, Chair Clem, thank you so much for being here, Lindsay, and for driving from Pendleton. And I just want to acknowledge for the rest of the committee, the caliber of people that you have on your board right now are outstanding. And Mr. Perry and Mr. Starkey are dedicated individuals who are very skilled and to the mission of what you're trying to do. I'm sorry they're not here today so everybody could have an opportunity to meet them, too, but we're delighted you were able to come. And thank you for your work. I guess my question to you is, this bill looks really simple. It's allowing research money to stay in the research fund that would normally have to move out. It's allowing a little more latitude in construction for you to accept gifts or funds from other sources. Is that the gist of what we're reading here? Are we making more of this than there is to be made?
Well, I think what is important here is, if it's a research fund, do you want to keep it specific to research? Or do you want to create opportunities that we modify a hatchery in a way? It may become through construction. It may be from a different type of a raceway, et cetera. And that, then the question comes up, is that money, should money be spent on that as research or not? That's going to be a policy decision that has to be made. And certainly with you folks involved in that. I would not want to see, this is my personal viewpoint now, I'm not speaking on behalf of the board, I would not want to see money from that just spent on a new roof for a hatchery.
I think to follow up?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. To the point of the committee, I think the intent was discussed that this is not for fixing roofs. So I think we've had that discussion. What I would like to get at is this accomplishing what you and your board are trying to accomplish in conjunction with the agency staff? Is this tight enough When this goes down to the Ways and Means sub that Representative Witt chairs, are we accomplishing what we're trying to accomplish here by allowing this long-term view of research, which we all know is going to supersede all of our tenures more than likely here, to get done what you need to get done, to answer the questions that Mr. Wolf has, that people around the world have, that us who live on the coast who care about fisheries have? I mean, is the wording in this correct to get done what you're trying to get done, or do we need to make some adjustments to this to make sure that all of the questions that we've asked are being answered? Do we need an amendment to this, or is this okay the way it is?
Well, I would say take a look at the language. Strengthen your borders around the construction fund section. Clearly delineate that, as I said, this doesn't go for the new roof of a hatchery. It goes to something that's focused on the research results, driving the hatchery into construction or something of that nature.
Okay.
So that it is directly linked back to research.
Okay. I think you've answered my question. Thank you.
And you want to make sure that the language in the bill describes that appropriately.
Yeah, that's...
Thank you.
Okay.
Chair Clem, may I just make one addition real quick? One of the things that once we learned that the fish follow the electromagnetic field of the Earth, and this is going to be research that's going to come at us in the near future, we asked the electrical engineers to go over to a standard hatchery raceway, and put his meter on the sides of the cement wall of the raceway. Put the probes on it. Electromagnetic charge in that raceway pegged the needle. And that's from all the pipe, all the rebar, all the electrical lines, all the valves, and everything in the hatchery raceway. Now, the question then comes up that we have to ask ourselves, we made the hatchery raceway. Did we make it so that it fouls up the electromagnetic portion of that fish's brain? Secondly, which also adds to it, we barge fish down the Columbia River, down through the last four dams, and release them below Bonneville. And they're inside the barge. That has generators, motors operating all the time, pumps on motors on pumps, etc. They're pushed by a tug, and a tug is an electro-generating facility all of its own, and it comes down through four of the largest hydro dams in the North American continent. And so then in addition to that, we put a magnetic tag in its nose. Now, that magnetic tag, when the fish returns, it comes through a screening device at the top of the fish ladder at each dam, and it tracks that fish, and it can tell you where it came from, you know, what stream, what tributary, and so on and so forth, in the Columbia River. Now, it sits right next to the sensory area that the fish uses for electromagnetic guidance. Now, again, good scientists did all this. But we've learned a little bit to this. And I think that's going to be another area that you'll see some investigation needing to take place.
Okay, we've got to get moving on to our another bill, but thank you, Lindsay, for joining us.
Thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2266 and reopen the House Bill 2321 public hearing and ask Scott and Glenn to join us. On deck is Bob, Rick, and Tom. So please, tell us about this bill.
Good morning, Chair Clem, Vice Chair McLean, Vice Chair Springer, members of the committee. I'm Scott Bruin, Director of the Oregon State Marine Board. I'm here to provide testimony on House Bill 2321. With me is Glenn Dalton. Glenn is the Aquatic Invasive Coordinator for the Marine Board, so if you have any really difficult questions, Glenn can probably answer those. We have ODF&W in back. If it gets really difficult, we can call them up as well. I did provide written testimony to you, so I'm going to go through this pretty quickly, PowerPoint, and give you some of the highlights, and then answer questions as you have those.
Okay.
A little background, this program started in 2009. In 2011, we updated to establish the mandatory inspection stations. Here's where our inspection stations are located, five of them, Brookings, Ashland, Klamath Falls, Lakeview, and Ontario. Stations are open seasonally. They're open daylight hours. We don't have them open at night, and sometimes their hours vary. That's what our fund has the money to support. This is a good graphic that shows where boats have come from that have come through our inspection stations in Oregon. So it's a pretty good graphic, especially when you look at where we have positive test results for quagga and zebra mussels in this country. Western states with positive test results, you can see those there. Montana is the latest on the list. They've had one water body that has tested positive for juvenile veligers within that water body. Subsequent tests have not tested positive, but it is something they're looking at and is certainly an issue for them. And it certainly shows that spread as aquatic invasive species move across the country. This is a little bit of a graphic of where invasive species are located. In the state, if you remember back to the graph I showed you of where boats are coming from that come to Oregon, they're coming from places that have infestation of quagga and zebra mussels. So it is a significant concern for us. Although I will point out, Colorado, the positives that were there are no longer there. They're negative. They have not found any additional results for mussels, as well as a couple of lakes in the northern area of Nevada. Our inspection stations continue to increase in the number of inspections that we're conducting. In 2016, we conducted 16,825 watercraft inspections. As we're able to open the inspection stations longer, we're getting more boats through, we're able to do more inspections. The other piece to that is the number of boats that are stopping at the inspection stations has increased as well, so we're able to inspect more boats. Looking at contamination data, in 2016, 374 contaminated boats, 17 with quagga or zebra mussel. That seems to be pretty consistent through the years of the number that come through that have quagga or zebra mussels on board. 51 of those were marine organisms, 11 with freshwater organisms, and 18 with other biofoulings. The big issue, of course, that we're worried about is the quagga and zebra mussel establishing themselves in Oregon. So as I spoke about, here's the number of the annual compliance percentage. It keeps improving as people know about the stations. The signage gets better. People are stopping. But we're still looking at about 18% are not stopping at the inspection stations to be inspected. So what does 2321 do? Well, the first thing it does is it requires that you open all drain plugs, bailers, valves, or other devices used to control draining water from ballast tanks, bilges, live wells, and motor wells. And this is before you leave the launch ramp area. And we said the boating access or riparian zone is how it reads in the law. The intent is you pull your boat and you drain it before you get into another drainage where whatever you pull out of that lake stands the chance of ending up in some other water body. So it doesn't mean that when you're sitting at the launch ramp, you hold everybody up while you're draining everything out and they're trying to get their boats out. Get it out of the water and then drain it before you leave that area. This is a recommendation that came to us. Other states have similar laws. Arizona, Kansas, New Mexico, North Dakota, and South Dakota all have laws requiring the removal of drain plugs on boats. Colorado, Montana, Nevada, North Dakota, Texas, Utah, and Washington all have laws requiring boats to be drained after use in a body of water. And it also requires that you keep those open while you're transporting the boat, so that whatever's in there as it sloshes around as you're transporting it, we get it out of there and the boat gets dried out, that we're not taking bilge water from one water body to another, but it gets drained out as you move along. The other piece that we have a problem with is law enforcement does not have the authority to require a boat that's bypassed a station to return to that station to be inspected. So we do have a Class D violation if you bypass a station, but then if the person says, well, I'm not going back, we have no authority to require that. So if the boat does have species on board, we have no way of investigating for that. The obvious answer is we'll have the law enforcement officer do the inspection right there on the side of the road. That's a an issue for the law enforcement officer from a safety perspective, getting in and out of the boat and trying to do that inspection from a safety perspective. The other issue is the way we wrote the law in 2011, we had concern about illegal search and seizure. And so the way the law is written is that only employees of ODF&W, ODA, and the Marine Board can conduct the inspections at the border. So law enforcement actually, the way the law is written, does not have that authority to do those inspections. So they really need to go back to the station to be inspected, and that's also where the decontamination equipment is located as well. The issue with requiring someone to go back to a station is that becomes a means of custody. And in order for you to have custody, you have to have a criminal citation as a result of that in order to take custody of a person and require them to go somewhere. That was something we learned as we were working with legislative counsel, trying to get this idea that we would have people move back to the station. And that's where the Class D misdemeanor for failure to return comes from, is that need to have a custodial situation in order for law enforcement to direct them back. We did look at ODOT's laws, and their laws read with trucks that bypass. If they're within 5 miles and the station is open, you can require them to return. So we adopted that as well. Obviously, if it's not open, they're not returning anywhere, and we're not stopping people 100 miles into Oregon and say, you know, you got to go back to that station to be inspected. So we put those parameters around it as well. The third piece, when the law was originally written in 2009, we adopted Idaho's law. And Idaho's law had an exemption for boats under 10 feet, and we just sort of adopted it straight as Idaho had written it. And this has been an issue in Oregon ever since the law came out. A lot of boaters don't take their small watercraft, their canoes and kayaks out of Oregon, so they say, why am I paying for something when I'm not bringing in invasive species? A lot of other boats, in fact, don't leave the state. And the way law enforcement explains it to people is we're all paying into something to keep these things out of our state. It may not be you that's going to bring them in, but we're all paying a share to keep invasive species out. Unless you have a boat under 10 feet, you're exempt. The other piece to that is having to measure how long a boat is. There's a lot of boats that may call themselves 9 foot 9 inches, but they're actually over 10 feet. So then we have law enforcement out there trying to measure the length of boats to determine who has to have an AIS permit. So it's been a constant course area of confusion for people. When we discussed this with our non-motorized advisory committee, they believe that we should get rid of the exemption for boats under 10 feet. Additionally, it does bring in additional revenue. We're running about a $400,000 shortfall in this account. This biennium, that will fulfill that shortfall, so we're not having to raise the rates on everybody else and all the other boaters as well. We have in rule that you're not required to have to carry an invasive species permit if you're under 14 years. That's something that we have in rule, but statute really doesn't allow that. Statute says that everybody needs to have an invasive species permit, so we wanted to put that into statute that if you're under 14, you don't need to carry one. This is, you know, especially families that are going out, and you have families with kids, it helps with the cost of that. And just in addition, requiring persons to cooperate with recommended boat decontamination process at a check station. That if they tell you you've got to be decontaminated, then you need to stay and be decontaminated. So that's the other piece of the bill that we added. So that's my quick run through the bill. Happy to answer any questions that you have.
Okay, Vice Chair Springer's got some. I've got some. Who else?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Preface my questions with back when I was a deputy and worked the road, I spent one summer, only one, as a Marine deputy. And I was still employed by my agency, but the Marine Board had contracts with local law enforcement agencies. Now, I wasn't on the coastal areas. I was in the middle of the valley. So, and we did a lot of boat inspections, not for invasive species. So as I'm thinking through this in practical terms, thinking about the 5 check stations that you had there, and those are manned with Marine. Let me lay out my question more clearly for you. That wasn't very good. Who mans those stations? And under what authority do they man those stations? Are they employees of the Marine Board, or are they contracts with local law enforcement? That's the first part.
Okay, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, those stations are manned by ODF&W employees. So we contract with ODF&W. They hire seasonal employees to run those stations. We do contract with law enforcement to do the enforcement for those that bypass the station. So if on a given day we'll fund law enforcement to be there, and if a boat goes past the station, they will then go stop that the vehicle towing the boat to enforce the laws for bypassing the station.
Thank you. Follow-up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, follow-up.
So, and yeah, as I started looking through this bill, my concern became the search and seizure portion of that. And so assuming there's a boat of the appropriate size that bypasses the station, and the people working the station call it into law enforcement, and law enforcement goes and pulls this boat over, they then have the right to require that boat and trailer to go back. But to be able to do that, we now have to qualify this as a misdemeanor passing the check station?
Yeah, Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, that's correct. That is my understanding working with legislative counsel, in order, because it becomes custodial at that at that point. You're directing them to go somewhere. Now, we're talking within 5 miles, so on I-5, that's 5 minutes that you have to stop them. So the only people that are being stopped are those where you have an officer at the inspection station at the time, and they're watching for boats
them
that
go
are
bypassing, by and they don't
bypassing the station in order to stop them.
Follow up, thank you, Mr. Chair. I understand and appreciate how devastating invasive species can be, and that's a huge, huge concern. Driving past a check station, elevating that to the level of an assault or a theft does concern me a little bit. And so I don't know that you have a response to that, but that becomes a really big deal to take away the rights of somebody based on not stopping at a check station.
And Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, I agree with you. That was a concern of ours. It definitely is not our intent going into this to have to raise it to that level. If there are other ways of getting there, we are certainly open to that. Our desire is that boats coming into Oregon have a chance to be inspected before they come into the state. We think that the threat is so big that if we do stop someone, they'll have a chance to get them inspected. And so this is our attempt to get to that place. And if there are other ways of getting there, then certainly we are open. We are open to that.
Mr. Chair, just a follow-up comment then. I share the goal with you, absolutely, and how important it is and how devastating invasive species are. I'm willing to work with you, the agency, or whoever, LC, whoever we need to get there in a different way.
Great.
Raising this to the level of a misdemeanor, it doesn't sit.
Great.
Well.
Yeah. Can I offer a clarification, please?
And please tell us.
For the record, Glenn Dolphin, the Aquatic Invasive Species Program Coordinator for the Marine Board. Chair Clem, Representative Springer. Well, there's actually two violations that we're talking about here. So we're not changing the violation for not stopping at the station. That currently sits at a Class D violation, I believe $110 for not stopping. That we're not changing in the bill. What we're adding is if the law enforcement officer determines that the boat really needs to go back and be inspected, then if you decline to go back to the station to be inspected, that's the Class C misdemeanor. And our intent is that if the boater actually complies and goes back for an inspection, that there would be no crime misdemeanor because you're actually going back to the station, not declining to go back to the station. Does that help clarify at all?
So officer pulls the person over only within 5 miles after having seen them drive past, says you have to go back. They say, nope, not going back. you get charged with this misdemeanor.
Correct.
Correct, right.
And that clarifies that, I feel.
And if the boat's, let's say the boat is clean, sorry, another follow-up,
yeah.
Chair Clem, Representative Springer. If the boat, let's say, is clean, it's sparkling, it's polished and waxed, obviously law enforcement officers, as you know, they all have discretion on how they interact with a violation that occurs. And so if the boat is obviously clean and hasn't been used in, let's say, 6 months or something like, the officer can determine that, yeah, this is a clean boat with no standing water. They don't need to go back to the station. Then they can just determine whether to issue a violation for not stopping at the station or not. But if they direct the boat to go back for an inspection, that's where the Class C misdemeanor would get in if they decline to go back.
I'm not comfortable, but yeah, I need
we'll
to
keep
work through this
a little
this. Bit.
Chair Clem, Vice Chair Springer, I'd love to work with you on this and work through that.
By definition, the fact that you have a Californian on board, there's already an invasive species right there, so let's just move on. Representative Witt?
Thank you.
I did not say that.
No, I did. I'm fine.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I too, am. Well, I entirely support... what this bill attempts to do. I think Section 2, Sub 1, at line 7, a person shall drain all standing or captured water, makes it exceedingly difficult for people to be able to comply with all captured water. And I'm wondering if we could not leave out that portion of it and just say that after leaving the waters of the state with a boat, skip down to sub 2, a person shall remove or open all drain plugs, bailers, valves, or other devices. And by virtue of having undertaken those actions, you are then in compliance with the law at that point, and not subjecting someone to having to determine whether all standing or captured water has been removed. Just simply by going through the mechanical process, then you've complied with the meaning of the law.
Chair Clem, Representative Witt, that is the intent. The intent is to open those, and so, yeah, I agree with you. I think we could get there with language like that.
Thank you very much.
Representative Power?
Yeah, and I'm conscious that we're running out of time, so I'm wondering if, based on your testimony, it looks like this bill is targeted specifically towards zebra and quagga mussels. Are there any other invasive species that this would help prevent getting in Oregon? And if so, if it is specific about the mussels, can you explain to us quickly about what the impact they would have on our waterways if introduced and established here?
Yeah. Chair Clem, Representative Power, I'm going to punt to Glenn here in a second, let him talk about specific species. But we do have species within Oregon that we don't want to be transferred, primarily aquatic vegetation, from one water body to another. So the opening of drain plugs does affect transport of species within the state. So that is a concern of ours. From where I sit and the money that we have available, we put as much of our resources as possible to try to keep quagga and zebra out because of the devastation they're causing in areas where they are located. Because they do get into municipal water systems, they do clog intakes, they are just devastating. They take the oxygen out of the water, which kills other species. So where they've established themselves and the costs of trying to eradicate them are significant. And while our aquatic vegetation is certainly an issue for us in Oregon, the impact and the way these mussels expand within the waterways, and then once you get them in one waterway, how do you keep boats from transporting the next one becomes an issue as well. Now we're putting gates around lakes trying to get boats not to move. So that's where the fear is of that group, although we do have New Zealand mud snails, we do have other things within Oregon that are a concern we certainly want to control as well. Do you want to talk about any specifics, Glenn, beyond that?
I didn't have anything to add unless you want a clarification.
Thank you. Representative McEwen, then come back over here.
Chair Clem, I'm going to make this really brief. Representative Power, I'd be happy to sit down and talk to you about the potential devastating impact of zebra and quagga. If they get in the Columbia or the Deschutes or any other river that has connections with irrigation systems, we're talking about $500 million to $1 billion a year just to control them if they get into our system of dams. They are incredibly devastating. And we've had a lot of testimony on this, but I'd be happy to send you some information or have a conversation about it. We're trying to, the whole Penwar region of northern, the northwest states in Canada are trying really hard to keep them out of this whole section of the continent. It's becoming really challenging, but it's because the devastation is just enormous if they get in. So this is a really, really serious issue.
Mm-hmm. Representative Escobar.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. To answer Representative Power on different issues, I saw in Alabama when I was down there for the National Sportsman's Caucus in 2008, they took a guy, dumped his aquarium in a lake. No big deal, right? Well, that little stringy vegetation in there took over the lake to the point where people couldn't go to their dock. I mean, it completely devastated that lake, and that lake was absolutely useless at that point. So that's just a plant.
Yeah.
So we've got some work to do here. One question I've got is, what is the purpose for adding in this line about the 14 years of age or older may not operate? But there been some confusion about really little kids and whether they're supposed to, and you're trying to make it clear they don't?
Chair Clem, the statutory language says all boats carry a permit. When the law came out in 2009, we put into rule those 14 years or older.
Yeah.
We want to make sure the law is clear that it is 14 years or older versus the Marine Board doesn't, I don't think, have the authority to have that exemption, but that's what we would like to have.
Okay, so we've got some issues, I think, that Vice Chair Springer can explore with both you and LC, if that's really the only option here on custody. I think you probably tried to meet with me, and I really didn't meet with anyone in January because I was busy working, but we should probably come and talk because I'm not so hot on the 10-foot exemption removal. And I don't know who else may have issues, but we won't be back to this bill anytime soon. For those of you who aren't here to testify, why don't you hold your comments until we actually have it in a form that's different. We'll also deal with Representative Witt's question or a point around maybe clarifying that language. And so I'm not going to continue the public hearing only because we're out of time anyway for this committee, and it'll be in a whole new form by the time it's ready to be commented on again. But thank you for that.
I'm going to say one thing.
Yeah, Vice Chair Springer.
Please contact my office today so we can sit down and start working on this.
Thank you.
Some good stuff here. It's ambitious, but there's some good stuff here. So let's close the public hearing on House Bill 2321. Let me just see. Mark and Eric from OWEB on this other one, how long are we talking? I don't want to make you come all the way back if it's really fast. But if it's not fast, then I'll have you come back.
Chair Clem, Maida Lofsgaarden, Executive Director of OWEB. There are a number of items, but they are fairly simple items. We'd be glad to walk
through minutes?
Less than 10, definitely. We could get through the items. So it's up to you. We're glad to come back if you would prefer.
Probably should. It's our first day, and I tend to break this rule every time, so why not wait till at least the second meeting before I break the rule and go into the transition period, because there's another committee that starts at 10.
Yep.
Okay. Thanks so much. So we're going to carry over the public hearing on House Bill 2321. Anything else for the good of the order? All right.
Absolutely.
Thank you for a good first meeting and adjourn the committee.
They ask questions.